The National Guard Bureau is assessing how the Wisconsin National Guard handles sexual assaults and harassment allegations. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. Between 2013 and 2017, the Wisconsin National Guard received 52 reports of sexual assault. Major Robert Bronya is a sexual assault response coordinator from the Wisconsin National Guard. Here's what he had to say on the Morning Show.
The process can be re-victimizing to people, and we take great care to make sure that we're putting the victim in the driver's seat as much as we can.
We're learning about how the Wisconsin National Guard investigates these incidents and what recourse may be available. Are you an active duty service member, or have you served in the past? Do you have concerns about sexual assault and harassment in the military? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joining us now is Caitlin Farrell. She's an investigative reporter with the Capital Times. She recently published a four-part investigative series into the Wisconsin Army National Guard and its treatment of soldiers who are sexually abused. Caitlin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is First Lieutenant Megan Plunkett of the Wisconsin National Guard. She says she was sexually assaulted by three different Guard colleagues over the course of 3 years. She was featured in Caitlin's investigative series. Megan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Megan, let's start with you. You were an officer in the Wisconsin Army National Guard from 2012 through 2018. You filed three reports detailing how you were sexually assaulted. Who did you report to, and how did the process work?
Well, originally, I reported a restricted report to the SARC, who we just heard, Major Robert Bronya. I filed a restricted report because I was experiencing severe debilitating symptoms that were interfering with my ability to function, and I wanted to receive counseling. So I filed a restricted report, which included contacting the SARC. I completed a form. He gave me two different locations where I could receive counseling, and that was that report. However, I knew that that wasn't going to stop these perpetrators from preying on other soldiers within the units that I had been a part of. So I also filed a report with the EO office, and that was back in so long ago. That took a long time to process. And during that time, over the years, I was retaliated against and re-victimized, and there were multiple other reports that I filed, most of which, despite making reports, investigations that by regulation were supposed to be initiated, they were not.
Caitlin, the National Guard allows those who experience sexual assault to make two kinds of reports, which Megan just referred to. Can you explain to us the difference between restricted and unrestricted?
Sure. Yeah. So the National Guard allows, like you said, folks to make two different types of reports. A restricted report is a report that one can file. It means that it really doesn't go anywhere. It's sort of just creating a record of an incident and filing that within the Sexual Assault Advocacy Office, as you saw Major Bronya. It's not until someone makes an unrestricted report, they always can change their restricted report to an unrestricted report. But the unrestricted report really triggers an investigation and allows a sexual assault victim's advocate to kind of get more involved and look into possibly moving a soldier from, you know, removing them from a unit. And that's really what triggers action. And so it's not until someone would file an unrestricted report that then the guard would automatically move to look to see if those claims could be substantiated or not.
And Caitlin, describe the process for us. Once someone reports a sexual assault in the National Guard, how does it make its way through the chain of command?
Sure. So my understanding is that, you know, first that report, a soldier must make an unrestricted report to the specific SARC. It's the Sexual Assault Response Coordinator. The National Guard has told me that then they look to see whether local civilian law enforcement, which has primary jurisdiction over those types of reports, want to investigate, pursue a case. Oftentimes, there's a pretty high bar and civilian authorities struggle to kind of bring those cases to light as well. But then there's an automatic administrative internal investigation process where states are supposed to outsource that to the National Guard Bureau, which is a federal administrative agency. And then their Office of Complex Investigations sends investigators to look at that claim. And that's what happened in the case of Megan as well. They had, according to the record, they had someone from OCI come in and look at her claims.
We're talking with First Lieutenant Megan Plunkett of the Wisconsin National Guard. She is a soldier who says she was sexually assaulted by three different Guard colleagues over the course of 3 years. And Caitlin Farrell is an investigative reporter with the Capital Times. She's looking into sexual assault and the Wisconsin Army National Guard. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Caitlin, the National Guard Bureau began its investigation this month into the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Tell us a little bit more about the National Guard Bureau and what it's going to be doing.
Sure. So, yeah, like I mentioned, the National Guard Bureau is a federal agency. It's jointly run by the U.S. Army and the U.S. Air Force. As you know, in Wisconsin, we have the Wisconsin Army National Guard, and we have the Wisconsin Air Force Guard as well. And so the Guard Bureau is set to come in. I understand that they've already sent some folks in to start collecting documents and reports that Wisconsin has had hold of for a while. Governor Evers is the commander in chief of the Wisconsin National Guard, and so he had to formally invite that bureau in. They're going to take about 6 to 9 months, I understand, from the Evers administration to do their investigation, and then with a report set to come out in early 2020. And Evers has said that he intends to make that public. Honestly, I don't quite understand, and I'm not sure many folks outside of the Guard really understand how the Guard Bureau does their investigation. They've done these types of investigations in other states. I know I've read reports that they've been conducted in Alaska, and that's one thing that I'm trying to work on right now to figure out, you know, how often they go into other states, what these reports look like. As I've really tried to drill down to understand how investigators are trained and how they look at these kinds of things, I'm trying to understand how they really do their jobs and how we know, you know, that a report's going to be thorough and objective, and how that's really done. I'm not sure that really, frankly, many elected officials nor members of the public quite understand that process.
U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin requested an inquiry, as I understand. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, she also sort of tag-teamed with Governor Evers to invite the Guard Bureau in. She also has initiated an investigation from the Inspector General for the Air Force Guard, but she went through the U.S. Air Force. And I believe that's ongoing as well. After she had other people come to her, the AP reported earlier this year that there were additional folks outside of Megan. Megan's with the Army. She had heard from a variety of Air Force Guard people who were speaking about problems that they saw. And then Senator Baldwin started to, you know, initiate an investigation even prior to some of the stuff coming out about the Army.
Following a request for comment, the Wisconsin National Guard says it has a robust program focused on protecting victims while educating all of our soldiers, airmen, and employees, and we actively work to create a culture that encourages reporting inappropriate behavior immediately. We're continuing the conversation of sexual assault allegations in the Wisconsin National Guard when we return. We continue in this discussion ahead. We want to know what you think. Do you have a family member or friend that serves in the military? What have they said about treatment of men and women who serve? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Sexual assaults have plagued the military for years. 2 years ago, there were nearly 6,000 reports from military members around the nation who said they had been sexually assaulted during their service. The National Guard Bureau is investigating the Wisconsin National Guard to protect the nearly 10,000 people who serve here. A representative for the Guard says it takes all allegations of sexual assault, harassment, or misconduct seriously, and eliminating it from the ranks has long been one of the organization's top priorities. Question for listeners: have you ever been the victim of a sexual harassment or assault? Did you report it? How are you dealing with the trauma, and what can you recommend to others? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Megan, what do you want to come from the National Guard Bureau investigation? What do you hope changes?
Well, the one thing that I really hope changes is that after the National Guard investigates the National Guard, government officials determine that we need a third party outside of the National Guard to be investigating the National Guard. Currently, the issue is that the military investigates and tries allegations of sexual assault within themselves. It's all in-house. There's no system of checks and balances. The issue with the Office of Complex Investigations is, as Caitlin stated, it's an office of the National Guard. The United States Government Accountability Office, GAO, published GAO-19-109, which is a report to congressional committees in December 2018. And it's about the National Guard OCI. And in this report, and I think that this highlights a lot of the trauma that I experienced and how I was re-victimized. This report, it states, I'm going to read this. OCI officials stated that investigators are required to complete an initial two-week training course conducted by the U.S. Army Military Police School, followed by 3 days of orientation conducted by OCI. In other words, these investigators received two weeks of training. During my investigations, now again, because OCI is part of the National Guard, the National Guard sets forth manuals, the policies and procedures by which investigations are supposed to be conducted. And those you can actually pull up online. And in the Chief National Guard Bureau manual, it's 0400.01. It states in pertinent part that the investigators will not prejudge the victim's credibility or truthfulness, including indicating disbelief through tone or body language. There's also military rules of evidence, and it includes not including any type of hearsay, slander, derogatory information. And so what I experienced and what I don't want others to experience is I had investigators investigating my accusations of sexual assault and rape who were untrained. They did not try to corroborate evidence. They did not interview witnesses that I gave them lists of. They did not interview any psychiatrist, psychologist, therapist that I had seen. They had not talked with any friends or family. What they did was they set out to discredit me and used only a few witnesses who used as evidence, literally saying, well, I heard from someone, although I don't remember from who it was exactly, but that Lieutenant Plunkett is not credible in her accusations of sexual assault because she had had sex previously with some other individual. And as Caitlin very well reports, one of the individuals from Protect Our Defenders commented on how unprofessional the reports were written and how it seemed like it was written by children, and he couldn't believe that these things were put on paper. And so ultimately what I want is anyone who comes forward with allegations of sexual assault are going to be treated with respect and are going to be receive thorough investigations, and they'll also have the representation with them, individuals who stay with them, Special Victims Council, the SARC, Child Defense, that say as a continuity of care across the years that these investigations take, so that the individuals aren't re-victimized by having to retell their stories to numerous individuals over and over and over again, and aren't getting the support that they're supposed to receive because the individuals who come in aren't sped up and prepared to present. And that's part of what I hope comes out of all of this.
Caitlin, how has the National Guard responded to Megan's complaints, assuming they have?
Right. Well, they're not able to comment publicly to me about her reports and how her investigations were handled. They cite the Privacy Act back from the 70s, which bars them as kind of a partially federal entity from discussing personnel details. And so, you know, that's one thing that does make reporting a story like this somewhat tricky, because I understand that, you know, federal law binds their hands in some ways from discussing how that was handled. But I also think that the reports that one really valuable thing about Megan being willing to come forward and share her story is being able to give to show records and sort of shine a light on how these investigations are done. And that's something that people, you know, we rarely see because the Guard is unable to discuss it. You can't get those types of records often through just going through a normal FOIA request, or they're overly heavily redacted. And so as a reporter, I think a lot of times the records really speak for themselves. And I really sought to showcase that throughout the story and bring in some experts both on sexual assault, military sexual trauma, and folks who deal with sensitive assault allegations like this to discuss that.
And Caitlin, what do Wisconsin lawmakers have to say about the allegations against the Wisconsin National Guard and the federal investigation that's been happening right now?
So the only state lawmaker that I've heard from who has really spoken publicly about this or seems to have followed it at all is Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who prior to the National Guard Bureau being invited in, had requested a review from Adjutant General Donald Dunbar about the National Guard's protocols and policies. He requested that a few months ago, and General Dunbar wrote him a letter, and I outlined that in the story, where he really just reviewed kind of the law that's on the books and the policies as they follow them, and said that it's really a priority to rid alleged perpetrators from its ranks. But Senator Fitzgerald has told me that, you know, he's still, I think, interested to see the results of what this investigation has to say, and would really like to see more, you know, more detail about what's going on, because he's heard from a variety of folks as well about in addition to Megan, about issues there.
Major Robert Bonya was on the morning show earlier this month. He's the sexual assault response advocate for the Guard. You include in your pieces that he says this is less an issue with the Guard than and more of a cultural problem in the state and the country. What do you make of that?
So, you know, I think that he is obviously an expert in that field, and I think he, of course, is entitled to that opinion. I think that there very well may be a broader societal cultural problem there. I do think that the Guard as a military entity is distinct, and you know, my aim as a reporter really is just to shine light on it. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the National Guard is the Governor Tony Evers is its commander in chief, and Adjutant General Donald Dunbar, who's been in the position since 2007. There's just not a lot of reporting that's really done about how things are done there. And so I do think that there are specific types of cultural issues and dynamics there that I've heard from other folks, again, in addition to Megan, and that I think their own internal report really highlights about the nature of it being not everyone in the Guard is part-time, but kind of the weekend warrior, the commanders that run units. You know, units are throughout the whole state, often in kind of rural outposts. And I think at times I've been told, you know, it's maybe difficult to kind of at all times from Joint Force Headquarters in Madison really keep track of and be in touch with what's going on at armories throughout the state. And it's just, you know, it's something that is integral to our state and that I think a lot of citizens don't have a great understanding of unless they or a family member have served in the Guard. And so, you know, maybe Major Bronya is right, but I do think that it's still worth to shed a light on trying to understand how this all works, because ultimately it's our tax dollars that are funding this.
Megan, you stand by your reports, even though investigators call them unsubstantiated. What is your current status in the Wisconsin National Guard?
The current status is that I am awaiting a decision from First Army as to whether I'm going to be medically retired, which I was, and then those orders were revoked, and that was part of retaliation. And the other option is a general under honorable discharge. And the reason for that, again, is due to retaliatory measures by the JAG of the Wisconsin Army National Guard.
Okay, and we're going to have to leave it there. Megan, thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time. Caitlin, also thank you so much for joining us. First Lieutenant Megan Plunkett is a member of the Wisconsin National Guard. She is a soldier who says she was sexually assaulted by three different Guard colleagues over the course of 3 years. Caitlin Farrell is the Capital Times investigative reporter. She recently published Failure to Protect, a four-part investigation into the Wisconsin Army National Guard and its treatment of soldiers who are sexually abused in its service. Coming up, find out why Wisconsin is sending hundreds of children out of state for mental health care. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. For a number of kids getting treatment for complex mental health needs, there are no options in Wisconsin. As a result, many of them are being sent to treatment facilities far away from their families and loved ones in places as far away as Utah and Georgia. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. He recently took a closer look at this issue as part of a collaboration with Wisconsin Public Television and their look at trauma-informed care. Here he is with Wisconsin Public Radio's J. Carlisle Larson.
So finding in-state facilities for children needing mental health treatment in particular hasn't always been an issue in the state. When did it start becoming a problem here?
The folks I talked to said that it really started becoming a problem around 2015. And it's been getting worse basically since then.
What's leading to that? What's causing this to get worse?
It seems there's a few factors, but the biggest one seems to be a reduction in the number of beds in state treatment beds at residential care centers.
Yeah, so these are places where these kids can actually go get the treatment they need, I think ideally in a space near home, but we're finding that that isn't what's happening anymore. So can you tell us a little bit about, the children that do need care and what kind of treatment they actually do need?
Right, yeah, so these are children with the most complex needs. The folks I talked to said that often they have issues with aggression, are at high risk for suicide. Sometimes they have a tendency to try to run away, which puts them at risk for trafficking. Essentially, they have really the most complex and high needs for behavioral health.
Sure. So these children in particular need a level of care that they're not getting at home, maybe aren't getting in the foster system, and so really do need these in-depth treatments. How have they been treated in the past? Obviously, 2015 was kind of a big moment for these facilities, but I guess taking a look back, what did it used to be like for these kids?
So it used to be that there were generally enough beds in state at residential care centers. But over the last 5, 6, 7 years, several of these centers have closed, and a number of others have reduced the number of beds that they have at their facilities that remain open. So it used to be quite a bit easier to find facilities in state for these children. In past years, it was maybe a dozen or so children who had to be sent out of state to facilities, and that number has really risen in the last few years.
Sure. And those facilities out of state, where are these kids actually getting sent?
All over the place. It's essentially where they can find, where the agencies can find facilities for them. So it ranges everywhere. In the last couple of years, kids have been sent to New Mexico, as far as New Hampshire, Texas, Georgia, Tennessee, Arkansas. A number of children have been sent to facilities in Tennessee, Georgia, and Arkansas. But it's really all over the place. And then also states close to Wisconsin as well, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan.
But still not here, not close to, you know, support systems that many, I think, mental health experts would want these kids close to. Can you describe some of these facilities, what's actually there, and I guess why they're so far? It kind of seems like they're, these are campuses nationwide.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know myself a lot about the specifics of some of these facilities. I know that a number of the children have been sent to Youth Villages, which has facilities outside of Memphis, Tennessee, and then others in Georgia as well. And these facilities are kind of on large campuses, have multiple levels of care within them. There are locked portions and unlocked portions. It's much more of a campus situation than I think a lot of the facilities in state are, because there is a range of care that's provided there. And then there's other facilities in other states that people I've talked to, in particular, an assistant state public defender, said that some of the facilities really feel a lot more prison-like. They have really high wire fences all the way around them. They're completely locked. Kids are being given kind of or forcibly given treatments that they don't want. So there's a really wide range in the types of facilities.
And can you talk a little bit about some of the treatments that public defenders take issue with that these kids are getting?
Yeah, the one that really stood out to me was the case of a child who was in a facility out of state who was forcibly sedated repeatedly. Is basically, I guess, for behavioral reasons, but that forcible sedation is not allowed in comparable facilities in Wisconsin, but it is allowed in some of these other states.
Insofar as you're able to answer this question, and maybe you can't, have any of these public defenders said, please don't do these treatments to these children, even though they're in your state? They're not here, but do any state laws, I guess, go to these facilities?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that they sometimes they have worked to get these children out of facilities that they feel are giving inappropriate treatments, or the ones that feel a little bit more prison-like. I know that they – and sometimes it is hard. It takes a while to get them a different placement just because options are so limited.
We're talking to Will Cushman right now. He's an associate editor of WisContext, and he's with us to talk about a dwindling number of beds at state-run facilities for children who have a whole range of mental health issues, issues with trauma, and many of them are being sent out of state for treatment and sort of the issues that, you know, come with sending those kids away. So looking back at, you know, some of these kids, as I mentioned, are getting sent out of state. What impact is that on those kids and their families?
Yeah, the folks I've talked to said that the impact is not great. Even though the children would be out of home anyway, it makes it more difficult to maintain connections with their families. I know that at some facilities they are allowed multiple kind of like teleconferences a week with their families. So that helps a little bit, but the families can't readily visit their child if they're 900 miles away. It just makes it really difficult. And they've also said that it makes it more difficult to transition children back into their communities after receiving treatment. There's a dislocation that goes along with these really long distances, and it makes it difficult to maintain care and get the kids back in the communities.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that familial connection gets a little bit strained as they're further away.
Exactly.
So, you know, part of the investigation or the look or the work that you did on this was part of a documentary out of Wisconsin Public Television that looked at the issue of kids being sent out of state for these complex mental health treatments. We're going to take a quick listen to Eileen Fredericks. She's an assistant public defender. And this is what she said about the problem.
I think people would be concerned if they knew that right now our options are so limited that we're sending kids out of state. We used to have a lot more options for kids, and I feel like they have just, over, you know, the past 9 years I've been here, just gotten worse and worse in terms of, you know, foster homes, group homes, treatment centers, all of them, those options have kind of gone away.
So having heard from Eileen, are we hearing the same thing from other public defenders?
Yeah, one of Eileen's colleagues actually is also quoted in the documentary and in the piece that's running on WisConText as saying that really he thinks that this situation is unconscionable, the fact that children are being sent hundreds of miles away from their families and their communities. And it's prompted him to speak out in a way that he normally wouldn't.
So the people that have been following this story have pointed to the fact that there is a lack of legal clarity when it comes to running one of these facilities, setting up one of these facilities. What are they saying here?
Right. So they're saying that the state right now bans "quote unquote" secured facilities, but there's a lack of understanding or lack of clarity about what the term "secured" actually means in practice. So people are wondering if a campus, a treatment facility, could have just one wing that's locked for certain purposes while keeping the rest of it open. That's one question. And then also there's a work group that Lance Horzhefsky was a part of also recommended that the state look reconsider its ban on the use of cameras in these facilities. I guess it's pretty much standard practice outside of the state in treatment facilities to record what's going on. It's considered a best practice. And right now, Wisconsin bans that practice.
So in closing, we don't have a lot of time left, but what do advocates want to see changed here?
Advocates want to see an increased number of beds in the state, and they also want to see less need for these beds in the first place. I think this is a part of a wider crisis in the child welfare system. I know I talked to a spokeswoman at the Department of Children and Families, and she said that they are really committed to reducing the need for out-of-home care in the first place, which would hopefully reduce pressure on these beds and allow these children with the most complex needs to stay in-state rather than being sent so far away.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks so much.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He talked to Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson about his look at the lack of in-state facilities for youth mental health treatment in Wisconsin. You can find his piece about this online at wiscontext.org. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Coming up next, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court considers whether laws passed during a lame duck session are unconstitutional. The court heard the case yesterday. Next, an area reporter briefs us on what we need to know and how long we might have to wait for the court's decision. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in one of the lawsuits over December's lame duck legislative session. The plaintiffs in this case argue the session itself is unconstitutional and should never have taken place. The defendants, of course, disagree. Do you think the legislature should be allowed to hold extraordinary sessions like the one they held during the lame duck in December? Or should that not be allowed? Why or why not? Should the legislature be allowed to set its own schedule, including holding extraordinary sessions, or should certain kinds of sessions be against the law? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Patrick Marley is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers state government and politics. Patrick, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so there are several lawsuits over the Republican-controlled legislature's extraordinary session last December. Which case did the court hear arguments on yesterday?
So this is the one was brought by the League of Women Voters and some other groups that alleges the way that lawmakers brought themselves into session was unconstitutional, and therefore everything they did during that overnight session should be invalidated. So they want to strike down all of the laws, all of the confirmations of appointments from former Governor Scott Walker because of the way they held their session.
And the defendants would be who?
So the groups actually sued the governor and the attorney general, I believe, in their not the attorney general. They sued the governor. They sued the state, essentially. Republican lawmakers intervened in the case so that they could defend what they had done.
So the again, the plaintiffs in the case are claiming that the extraordinary session and the fact that it was held in the first place is what's unconstitutional. Let's talk a little bit about the legal theory there. What
Sure.
does the Wisconsin Constitution actually say about when the legislature can be in session?
So the Constitution just says that the legislature can meet when the governor calls a special session, or when it can meet when provided by law. So the law itself that the legislature says when it meets doesn't describe extraordinary sessions, doesn't talk about extraordinary sessions in any way at all. And so the groups say that means they can only hold regular sessions, essentially what they schedule at the beginning of each two-year term as to the dates they're going to meet. And since 1980, lawmakers have had their regular session and have also created these extraordinary sessions, which essentially means they can bring themselves into session at any time when they're not otherwise scheduled to be there.
But nobody has sued them for this before.
That's right. They've been doing this for 40 years. Nobody has ever raised this legal argument. So it's not like there's no precedent on it. It's just nobody's challenged this activity for four decades.
We're talking with Patrick Marley, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You were in court when the arguments were being made. What did the justices have to say about all this?
So, the court right now has a 4-3 conservative majority. That's going to grow to 5-2 in August when Brian Hagedorn comes onto the court. But it looks like for this case, it'll be this current makeup of the court. And the conservatives were pretty skeptical of the claims being made in this lawsuit, saying that courts generally defer to the legislature in terms of how it operates and its own proceedings. The liberals, on the flip side, seemed very much to be backing those bringing the case and questioning how they could hold these sessions if there's no explicit law allowing extraordinary sessions. The caveat here is that two of the justices didn't say anything at all. Liberal Justice Shirley Abrahamson didn't ask any questions, and Conservative Justice Annette Ziegler didn't ask any questions or say anything. So neither of them tipped their hands. But for the others, they sort of fell along ideological lines in their views. You know, you can only read so much into questions, but it appeared that, the conservatives were leaning toward the Republican point of view and the liberals toward the Democratic point of view.
Some Republican lawmakers have said that if this suit against them succeeds, it would reverse years of laws that have been passed during previous extraordinary sessions. Is that a possible outcome? Could that really happen?
I don't think this decision itself would have an effect on anything beyond the lame duck laws. But if the court were to strike down the lame duck laws by saying that extraordinary sessions were unconstitutional, certainly any number of people could raise claims that all of the other laws passed over the last 40 years were improperly passed and should be invalidated. Those bringing the lawsuit say, no, this case is narrow to just this set of laws, and the court can sort of deal with things that were passed many years ago. You know, perhaps the statute of limitations is passed and that there's no further ability to challenge them. But yes, that's an absolute possibility that legal claims like that could be made if this case went the way that the League of Women Voters and others are asking the court to go.
What are other possible outcomes if the plaintiffs win this case and extraordinary sessions are declared unconstitutional?
Well, you would have the legislature meeting less often. You know, the lawmakers say that they need to have the ability to hold extraordinary sessions so that they can respond to problems that might arise, issues that might come up that they don't anticipate when they set their calendar at the beginning of the term. We just had 8 years of one-party control of state government, and I think when you had unified government, you wouldn't really see an issue because the governor and the legislature are likely going to have a similar view, and if you couldn't have extraordinary sessions, the governor could still call a special session. You could see a real difference here in a time of divided government. If the legislature can only meet on the days specified at the beginning of its term, something happens a year and a half later, Governor Evers might not agree with the Republicans who control the legislature and just might not bring them into session, and the legislature would be unable to meet.
We probably won't get a decision on this case until the summer. What happens in the meantime?
So, I mean, I think it's important to note that we've got these other cases that are also brewing. There's one in federal court, another one in state court to challenge the law in different ways. So this is not by any means the end of the road. This does look like the case that will get resolved the soonest. The court likely will rule by the end of June. And that will sort of determine whether you can have these sessions or not. From there, the focus will be on the specifics of the laws and whether those violated any terms of the state constitution or the federal constitution. And that's going to be, you know, these lame duck laws, which limited the powers of the governor and the attorney general and did some other things. There are a lot of different elements of them, and these other lawsuits sort of challenge them piece by piece. So with future rulings, you wouldn't see sort of an all or nothing decision. You'd more likely see a court scrutinizing a particular part of the lame duck laws to determine if
What was the basis for the federal lawsuit?
That case is in a very early stage. We haven't really seen much from it, but it was brought by the state Democratic Party, and they alleged that the lame duck laws violated the First Amendment rights of Democratic voters and organizations like theirs, because it, after voters said they wanted Democrats to hold top office, they pulled back the authority that those offices hold.
How long should we anticipate that these legal battles are going to go on?
It's hard to say, particularly in the federal court case. I don't think it would be surprising to have this going on for another year or even past the 2020 election. The state Supreme Court is moving pretty quick here, clearly with this case. The other case, which was brought by some unions, part of that case is already at the state Supreme Court. I think you could see that one resolved by fall or early next year. But federal courts move more slowly. It's hard to say how long that would go, particularly if it gets appealed, which I think is likely. And then you could be talking a year or two before we really know the way this all plays out.
All right, Patrick Marley, thank you for joining us.
You bet.
Patrick Marley is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers state government and politics. Coming up just ahead, we'll talk about how geek culture has become pop culture over the last decade, but not everyone is welcome to participate. That's all just ahead on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show.